Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. I'm Chelsea Damon, and today we are going to talk about Shiite militias. We had Philip Smythe on the show, oh my goodness, I think it was a couple of years ago at this point now, and you talked about the subject, but there's been so much going on in Syria and Iraq and elsewhere that we figured we just needed to get Philip back on the show to talk about this. So first of all, welcome back to the Loopcast, Philip.
Thank you for having me back. I'm shocked. I mean, I thought that you guys had just put a ban on me. I didn't feel loved.
No, we do. We do love you, Philip. So welcome back.
Well, thank you.
So for those who might not know Philip, his research focuses on, like I said, Shiite militias. He is a researcher at the University of Maryland and also the author of the blog Hezbollah Cavalcade. And he is also a new Soroff Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. So first of all, a huge congratulations on that. That's great news. I'm very excited for you.
Thank you.
And he also has a great monograph also from WINAP, Washington Institute for Near East Policy, called The Shiite Jihad in Syria and Its Regional Effects. So if you're interested in this topic, I would highly recommend that you check that monograph out. It has loads of information on the topic. So to start off with, why don't we just have a little recap of where we are today with the so-called Shiite Jihad?
We are a lot of places. You know, it's interesting. There's been some pushback even in terms of calling them jihadists. And I have a friend out in Austria who actually wrote a piece about this who said that, you know, we should be calling them not jihadists but mukawamists. So excuse me if I'm going off onto a tangent about their naming, but you know, I'm kind of firmly in the camp that we should be calling them jihadists because they, you know, truly believe that they are fighting a jihad. And you know, I've noticed that academic discourse when it comes to dealing with the Shia, it's almost like treating them as if they're not part of the Muslim world in some cases. You know, they're their own thing, and there's this kind of tone that comes with it. Well, no, their jihad is slightly different from, you know, the guys in Al-Qaeda or ISIS. So that must mean it's not jihad, as if, you know, there's only one flavor that's allowed. And I tend to push back against that. But I will tell you what's going on in their world. Well, there's a lot going on. I tend to focus on the Iranian-backed guys because there are other Shia jihadists who are, you know, not backed by Iran, and sometimes they, you know, will even work with other regional actors to achieve other goals. I mean, hell, the Iranians do too. But the Iranians are really demonstrating that these different groups that they've built, and they're usually built along a structure that looks like Lebanese Hezbollah's, that these groups really are, they're making a ton of headway in the region. And this goes from Lebanon through Syria, in Iraq especially. You kind of see the Iranian influence when it comes to their use and partnership with Ansar al-Law in Yemen, you know, the Houthis in Bahrain. And this is, I mean, I did a lot of work. I mean, a lot of the original work on Bahraini militancy for, you know, this go-around, you know, starting from the revolutionary period during the Arab Spring, they have had a ton of influence on that as well. So they've made a lot of headway, as I said before, and it's quite interesting to see how, you know, they're operating, because when we think of a jihadist group, you know, most people, because of, you know, the conditioning that goes on due to media and due to a lot of other academic pieces, is that, you know, jihadist groups don't really want to participate in electoral politics, or they don't want to do this, or they don't want to do that to function with a state or within a state apparatus. And I would actually, you know, make the argument that these groups, you know, we look at Iraq right now, you have a ton of different organizations. Many of them are under the officially recognized umbrella of al-Hashd al-Shaabi, or the what they call the Popular Mobilization Forces. And a lot of these groups or those who are connected with them are now running in, you know, in the elections. I mean, Hezbollah has run in a number of Lebanese elections, and you know, some of these groups in Iraq have run before. But it's a very, very interesting method that they have in order to eventually dominate a society and eventually take it over. It's not simply, you know, via cutting people's heads off or blowing things up. It comes down to a combination of different policies. And I mean, when you focus on it that way, you can kind of see how strategically minded they are. I mean, it's a very, very kind of long-term strategy that they have and a long-term plan. You know, and for those of us in the United States, where we're all about instant gratification and we you know, want to see things boom, 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 and we try to work with whatever we're given, it muddles the picture of what they truly wanted to at different times.
And so what you just mentioned seems very interesting in contrast to Sunni jihadists, where, as you said, we have this idea that if you're not willing to get involved in sort of the electoral and organizational, government organizational entities, that you're not truly a jihadist. And I'm actually glad you brought up the concept of, should we still call it a jihad with Shiite groups or not? Because that was one of my questions. So how can we compare and contrast this difference with Shiite versus Sunni?
Well, for most literature, and actually given you're doing a lot of ISIS work, I mean, you could even tell it better than I can.
This is your show.
This is my show, but
go for it.
Well, hey, I try to open it up. You know, I defer. I defer to wisdom when it's there. But it's what I would say is, for most people, when you think of a jihadist organization, like let's say the Islamic State, these are people who are, you know, their main push, kind of their main idea is violent force. Violent force will create the ends that you want. It's not simply one piece of that's kind of a means to an end, but it's, you know, it's excuse me as I'm trying to calibrate my thoughts here. When we look at Sunni jihadism, you know, the whole force element, that's the most important thing for many of them. But it's kind of interesting when you look at it, because there are some Sunni jihadist groups like Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Hell, it has jihad in the name, that, you know, will also engage in sometimes electoral politics, sometimes they will have other social programs. So it's not kind of clear-cut across the board, like Sunni Shia, you know, they fall into, you know, one branch of jihadism or not. But what I would argue is a lot of the recent work that's been done on it, because there's so much focus on ISIS, there's so much focus on Al-Qaeda, and there's so much focus on, you know, the thinkers who really are making those ideas kind of either come to fruition or trying to push them quite a bit, it has kind of taken the mantelpiece and eliminated a lot of the more detailed analysis when it comes to what these groups actually are. Now, it's interesting when you're talking to somebody who would say, I want to call, you know, these Shia groups Shia jihadist groups, and for a large part, it's because that is one of their declared goals. You know, they, you know, you look at a group like Hezbollah, and their main goal, it's not simply Islamic resistance. I mean, that's wrapped into their concept of jihad, but their goal and their mission is the jihad. They don't hide that. And they've engaged in you know, violent actions before. You know, I think there's this other thing where when we think of jihadism, it's usually utilizing asymmetric tactics or terrorism. And it's not always, you know, fighting a normal kind of land battle. But it's the other side of this is, and I'm sure you've seen this with studying the Islamic State, you know, all of these groups really want to build up true armies. They don't just want to be some rinky-dink force, you know, with a few Katyushas and, you know, a guy with a Kalashnikov. They want to build, you know, an actual force that they can, you know, conquer territories that they can have. I mean, sometimes it's dream work. You know, sometimes it's just... you know, they're pulling the stuff out of space. You know, what would they really like to see? But I will say this for groups that are, especially these Iranian-backed Shia jihadist organizations, they have a unifying ideology, which is called absolute wilayat al-faqih, where technically loyalty goes to the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. So the loyalty goes there, and they follow his orders, and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, for which many of them are part and parcel of, because it's part of a larger transnational network. You know, it's kind of interesting when you juxtapose this to a group like let's say the Islamic State. You know, they have their own branches, different places too, right? You know, it's you're building something not along nationalist lines. It's kind of interesting. Khomeini, you know, the main ideologue who helped craft much of the ideology that groups like Hezbollah prefer. You know, he was very much against the idea of a nationalist state. You know, he thought of the entire ummah, the entire Islamic population, as being the state. You know, and it didn't matter. The borders didn't really matter. Now, obviously, you'll see different changes over time where certain groups, like even Hezbollah, they will take certain nationalist language and use it. You know, and it'll sound like, oh, well, you know, they're actually Lebanese nationalist, or, you know, better organizations actually Iraqi nationalist. But at the end of the day, their ideological belief is not really along those lines. You know, it's again, it's a means to an end. So I'm sorry if I'm going all off. There's so many things I want to cover, and I'm just jumping down every little rabbit hole and have no organization on that.
Oh, no, it's fantastic. You learn so much from all of this, and going down rabbit holes is a good thing on the Loopcast, so we definitely approve it. How would you say that the Syrian war has either affected or amplified Shia militia jihadists? How has that changed the playing field?
Well, in many ways. I mean, I think it's important to understand the background history first, though. You know, these groups didn't just pop up because, you know, Bashar al-Assad was threatened and all of a sudden they started sending over thousands of guys. No, you know, they had been created. There had been networks that the Iranians were using, and also networks that even Bashar al-Assad was using in his own country of Shia militiamen. These guys have been around, what? Hezbollah was formed in the early 1980s, the Better Organization around the same time. You had different organizations in Bahrain which were militant. Some of them which were more active in the 1990s, and some of the leaders there were in some of the same Bahraini jihadist kind of circles these days. So it's you know, a lot of the same figures, and a lot of there's a lot of history back there. But coming to your point, to your question, Syria changed it in many ways. One, these forces were no longer, like I mentioned before, they were no longer these kind of just asymmetrically focused units. You know, like Hezbollah is fighting the Israelis, you know, or they're fighting, you know, a militia foe that happened to be in Lebanon in the 1980s, or they're countering the government, like in 2008, you know, even though the Lebanese army wasn't, you know, fighting them. It wasn't like that. Now they were fighting, in some ways, a counterinsurgency, where they're fighting Sunni rebel groups, Sunni jihadists, and a lot of other different organizations that they don't like. But they're also functioning more like a cohesive army. And when I say a cohesive army, you know, these groups are essentially formed like a Shia foreign legion for the Iranians. You know, you're picking a couple thousand out of Iraq, you're recruiting them. You have some from Afghanistan, you've got some from Pakistan, you've got some from Lebanon, you have some that are from within Syria. So there's quite a spread in terms of the nationalities that are involved and the languages involved. You have Iranians who are there too, yet they're all fighting for a common goal under, you know, under a number of common banners, and for, you know, what they say is, you know, the common ideology. When you see something like that, we're talking now tens of thousands of fighters. They've had combat experience, and the combat experience isn't just them blowing up an IED. The combat experience is driving tanks. The combat experience is using, kind of being part of combined arms warfare, where Russians are launching airstrikes. And mind you, this is from Russia. Russia launching an airstrike for a Shia jihadist organization, so that they can advance along their own lines. You have to learn a lot in a very short period in order to do that. And you have to have really, really good connections with your allies in order to make it all work. And I think it's quite huge. It's quite huge. And when you look at, what Khomeini really wanted, and Khomeini has a number of speeches about this, about building, you know, this army of Hezbollah, you know, this party of God, that this is kind of the structure that he would have liked, that he would have liked to see, and, you know, how they feel they're going to achieve their concept of the Islamic Revolution. And of, you know, liberation for these people, or for, you know, the new order that really should be reigning over Earth. So there is that distinct kind of change. The other change that happened with it is, you know, I mentioned that Khomeini himself, he believed that the entire Islamic Ummah, Sunni and Shia, were, you know, part of the same thing. Obviously, it had more of a Shia bent to it because, you know, Khomeini was a Shia cleric. You know, he got a lot of his authority from that, and, you know, there's no denying he was a Shia. And for a time, he was kind of the only show in town, so it was interesting to see how some Sunni groups would kind of kowtow to him or would deal with him. But the Syrian war really, it showed a high level of sectarianization that was going on within the region. And I know that that word has become kind of dirty because you get a lot of academics who look for nuance where there is none. But, you know, this is really how it started to boil down. And we're talking about the fighters that are involved with a lot of these groups. So if you join Hezbollah, you know, you have to have a really strong ideological education in order to become part of the group. Now, a lot of that has, because they need new recruits, they need replacements, a lot of that has filtered away over time. I'm not going to say it's completely gone and they're just this ragtag militia that just throws guys up into the front. Like, it's not like that. But, you know, they are loosening certain restrictions in terms of age and in terms of religious commitment, ideological commitment. So you do have that issue. And what does that allow for? It allows for kind of this old sectarian notion, the old sectarian notions to kind of creep in and say, no, Hezbollah is not, you know, an Islamic jihadist organization. It's Shia Islamic. And you'll hear little hints of this in terms of how many of them are speaking. Even Nasrallah, and you could read this a few ways. He deliberately says it in a few ways because he's a pretty good public speaker. You know, he said in a speech, I'm trying to think, it was either in 2013 or 2014, but my mind is skipping on me on this one. You know, we are we are Shia. We are Shia first and foremost, and if, you know, ISIS or Nusra want to attack us, well, you know, here we are. But when you say something like that, then, you know, what kind of messaging do you really think that sends to the rank and file who can read it a few different ways? You know, the PR message would say he's just saying that because, you know, ISIS and these other groups come out and say they want to kill all Shia and, you know, he's sticking it to them. Well, I could read that if I were, you know, a Shia fighter and I know a number who have, saying, ah, our focus is to defend Shiism, which is true Islam. This other stuff is just a joke. You know, this other stuff is just bad. It's corrupt, and we need to fix it, and we're going to be the people who do fix it. So it's kind of interesting to see it from those lines. Now, mind you, this is all at the same time when they are trying to pull in Christians into different aligned militias with these Shia jihadist organizations, and also they're trying to recruit Sunnis, too, to do their bidding. So there's a high level of pragmatism here, and, you know, it's I'm sorry I keep saying it's like I said before, but it is, like I said before, they have a long-term strategy and a long-term plan. It's rather linear when you really focus on it and see what goals they're trying to achieve. But, you know, for many, they want to open this can of worms and say, but there's a nuance here, and you're really kind of missing this line there. I would just say this, you know, the sectarianization that happened during the war, I don't think it's going to go anywhere in terms of correcting itself so that Hezbollah can return, or Hezbollah or any of these other Iranian-controlled Shia groups can really go back to that old standard where they could kind of at least give some window dressing and say, yeah, but we're pan-sectarian, you know, we're not sectarian, we're pan-Islamic, you know, it's all okay. I think that notion has been quite harmed. Do I think it's unfixable? No, I mean, you know, I'll use one of these annoying, stupid cliche statements that you always get, you know, the sands of the Middle East are always shifting, you know, one of those lines. But it is kind of like that because, you know, you have to be a realist and pragmatic when it comes to politics. And I think, you know, many people are there because you got to deal with the forces on the ground. So those two, you know, kind of this alteration from being simply an asymmetric type of fighting force, and it was, you know, not as well organized, you know, in this transnational form, that has definitely changed. The sectarianization element has also changed. But then there's one more piece to this that I think is rather important. In terms of governmental influence and in terms of political influence, these groups are really at, you know, they're I don't want to say it at their apex, because then that would make it seem like this is the top of the top. But for the moment, they are really reaching heights that could not have been achieved a number of decades ago. whether it was because the force size or other issues they're dealing with. But right now, their influence in the regional political kind of schemo, that regional sphere, is quite different. And I can see why. You know, you look at the Gulf and you look at a lot of other countries, they're looking at this and saying, you know, what's next? How do you address this in a policy form? And how do you address this, you know, if it really comes down to a military struggle? And I think what we've seen recently, you know, with an Israeli fighter jet getting shot down, one of the F-16s got shot down, and they were bombing a lot of Iranian and Assadist sites, you know, now we're seeing what could possibly happen in the future. It's maybe a far more bloody and protracted conflict involving a lot of different groups and a lot of different a lot of different pieces of geography too. So it really has been a paradigm shift in many respects, but you know, it's moved that way because there's always been this progression there. You know, it's this slow moving wheel.
So I have a feeling I know how you're going to answer this question, but I'm still going to ask you. Does Iran still play a prominent or the prominent role with the center of this jihad, the Shiite jihad?
It does. And, you know, Iran, since its revolutionary beginnings in 1979, since the Islamic Revolution, this has been a goal of theirs. See, I don't want people to think that Shia jihad or even, you know, Shia militias or Shia fighters or Shiism in general is just, you know, something that belongs to the Iranians. It does not. There's a lot of gray zone and there's a lot of dissension and one could even call it turmoil in some respects. And I mean this from a theological level, ideological level too, from the military angle, from the political angle. It is a far more diverse group than many people are even want to be aware of. And there's a lot that can be said and done. But in terms of the Iranians came to the board with you know, a new ideology, a new way of thinking about theology, their own theology. And beyond that, they have a state to back them up. So you have a lot of senior Shia clerics, a lot of them based out of Najaf in Iraq. You have, you know, other Shia clerics in other places. But they don't have the power of state backing. They don't have the power of, well, we have a national army, we have a Revolutionary Guard Corps, we've got an Air Force, we've got a Navy. They don't have that. They do have a lot of money sometimes because they have different foundations that are all over the place and they've got, you know, supporters giving them money. But many of these different clerics, you know, they are not invested in creating the, you know, a new Islamic utopia. You know, that's not really their MO. It's not really their end. You know, they are more focused on you know, things that are usually involving jurisprudence and whatnot, you know, the nitty-gritty religious subjects. Whereas Iran, you know, they really have an end in mind, and they've constantly tried to build it. So, you know, when I say they've constantly tried to build it, we're now talking in Iraq. I still remember this. I had counted a bunch of them out. In 2014, you had upwards of 50 to 200 different organizations that had announced themselves, this is by 2015, that had announced themselves that they were mobilizing and going to fight, you know, ISIS in that country, or they were even going to mobilize and start sending people to Syria. I did a little study on this for the Atlantic Council some months back, where, you know, I was counting the different groups announcing recruitment activities and also deployment activities within Syria. So you had around 50 groups there. So a lot of these developments, you know, these are being pushed with cash. They're being pushed with clerical links. They're being pushed with, you know, governmental links. A lot of these militia leaders will wind up in, you know, official Iranian offices, and, you know, they'll say, hey, you know, it's so great to have you guys on board, you know, for the Islamic Revolutionary Project. So yes, I mean, the Iranians are the big drivers for it. And the other bigger thing is it having these groups drives and assists their regional goals. So they needed to back up Bashar al-Assad because he's their strongest Arab world ally, you know, an official ally, head of state. And in order to do that, they used their Shia militia Foreign Legion, and they trained new people to do it too, new people to fight alongside them. So these guys have been very, very beneficial for them when it comes to achieving a lot of different goals within the region.
Who are the more prominent Shiite militia brigades? Maybe tell us a little bit about some of the top brigades that you've researched and their organization and elements and so forth.
Sure. Hezbollah, obviously, it's the first among equals when it comes to groups that are controlled by the Iranians that are doing pretty much everything across the region that they want to do, and in terms of also training up new groups. So Lebanese Hezbollah really takes a very, very prominent place on the mantle when it comes to this. But, you know, we need to look at Iraq, too. And Iraq, I've observed this from another angle. Why are there so many groups that are allowed to exist in Iraq when you have Khomeini's ideology, who said he actually came out and said he would hope that all of these different kind of Hezbollah-style groups would eventually coalesce into, you know, a unified Hezbollah. And I said before, you know, they're kind of doing that in Syria, but then why would you allow for the creation of, you know, a ton of different little splinters who all kind of believe in the same thing, but have different leaders and different this and different that? So in Iraq, you look at this, what are the most prominent out of there, and why are they functioning in this way? Well, you have a group like Badr Organization. Badr Organization was initially the Iraqi Hezbollah. You know, that's kind of how they were envisioned. They were the quote-unquote armed wing, and by the way, back then they were called Falak Badr, or the Badr Corps. And so when the Badr Corps was around, they were part of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which was technically the political umbrella. And, you know, eventually this group was added on to SCIRI, and that's the Supreme Council, when they got into Iraq after America invaded. And then the Badr Organization splintered off when SCIRI became ISKI. They changed their name. And then they became their own, you know, separate group. But obviously, you know, this is a militia organization. It's built around arms. It's built around, you know, a history of fighting Saddam Hussein's regime, and also fighting other regional foes, and also even the Americans. You know, there's weird connections that go into that group there. So anyway, Badr Organization, I would say, is probably the most major right now for the Iranians when it comes to Iraq. And why is this? Well, the Badr Organization, because of their plays in electoral politics, they're now running the interior ministry in Iraq, and that's quite a position to have. And you know, I'm sure you know this. You know, in Iraq, a lot of the ministries will have security forces attached to them that are paid officially, and eventually, you know, you bring on your own friendly guys who are in your party, and then an entire ministry gets taken over, and you have an officially recognized, you know, militia that's not really going as a militia and still gets state pay. So the Badr Organization has been able to do that quite effectively. But there have been some changes. You know, there have been other splinters that have occurred. There have been other moves that have happened. So Iraq, it's not simply Badr. Now, Badr is what we could call kind of the old school Khomeinist thought when it comes to dealing with Iraq. But there are other groups, and the Iranians have been very keenly interested in splintering Muqtada Sadr's forces. And I'm obsessive when it comes to this stuff. I love studying Sadr's splinters because sometimes the stories are just, like, hilarious for why they split. Like, you talk to some of these guys, and they'll go, yeah, but we're really unhappy with this today. Okay, so you started another group, and then you went back, and then you did this. Okay, that's interesting. But you know, there were a ton of these Sadr splinters that were formed, and they were not simply formed at the time. You know, you had groups like Asayab Ahl al-Haq, which was formed out of Muqtada Sadr's Jaish al-Mahdi, or the Mahdi army. This was during the American occupation of Iraq, which lasted from, 2003 until 2011. You had, you know, a group like that, but the focal point of the group wasn't simply to attack Americans and to blow them up, but it's also to put pressure on Muqtada Sadr. It's also to put pressure on the government. It's also to put pressure on this and on that. So it was kind of a multifold reason why a group like that was formed. And the interesting thing is, I mean, Asayab Ahl al-Haq, being a Sadrist splinter, you know, they try to play up. They are a Khomeinist group now. That's the ideological message that they push. But it's interesting how they try to incorporate figures like Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Sadiq Sadr, who, you know, was Muqtada Sadr's father, but they're trying to say, no, we are the successor group. We are the true followers of Sadr's ideology, not Muqtada. And so, I mean, you see little elements like that that are kind of filtered in there. But that group has become rather powerful. They didn't do too well in the last elections, despite the fact that, you know, they had a lot of prominence. But who knows, now that the 2014, you know, ISIS crisis happened, and given the forces that they sent to the battlefield and the reputation that they had as being, you know, tough and rather vicious fighters at times, you know, maybe they can actually take more of the governmental pie during another election. I mean, there's other groups like Kitab Hezbollah. Kitab Hezbollah, which was formed directly with the assistance of Lebanese Hezbollah and, you know, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in Iran, these guys aren't really getting involved in Iraq's politics, and they haven't. You know, they've been offered these positions sometimes where they'll say, oh, well, if you lay down your arms, we'll allow you to be involved in politics, and, you know, you don't really need to do your own thing. And so they're a prominent group in terms of they can always have a spoiler effect, not just against the Americans, but against pretty much anyone they want. And they're very, very well funded. And the interesting thing is when there were problems within that group, there was a splinter again. And so you had Kitab Sayyid al-Shuhada, which was formed. And this was in 2013. And by the way, that group has, I think, one person, their former secretary general, who's now a parliamentarian from Basra. So, I mean, you kind of see how a lot of this works, you know, with the splintering and which groups are the most prominent. But I would say that those three are rather important when it comes to Iraq. Obviously, there are countless other groups. I could really get into that. But it's, I don't just want to focus on the Iranian stuff for you guys. So it's there are other elements to this, too. So if we look at what happened with Ayatollah Sistani. So Sistani is the probably has the highest clerical rating, if you will, you know, out there for Shia clerics in terms of the scholarly work he's done and the respect that he has. And so there are a number of groups within Iraq that also follow his lead. They don't want to follow the Iranians. They don't really want to deal with them, you know, because they see a certain level of threat to their own interests that are coming from that end. So there's one group in particular, which I would say is, you know, not just powerful, but it's also built a lot of good connections with the Iraqi army, called Firqat al-Abbas al-Qataliyyah. And that group hasn't sent people over to Syria because, again, you know, Sistani has said, don't send Shia fighters to Syria, something the Iranians definitely push back against. But this group has gotten some very, very good training. They have some very, very good fighters. They generally push an Iraqi nationalist message. And they've been in a few, you know, controversial scrapes before, but you have an organization like that. Next on the list would be Muqtada Sadr and his Saray al-Salam. And where I'm sitting right now, I actually have a gigantic Saray al-Salam flag behind me. And Saray al-Salam was essentially the successor group to the Mahdi army. But with Sadr, you know, because of all these splinters that have occurred because of Iranian pressures, you know, he's tried to maintain a really tight watch over his group. So it's interesting to watch how they've performed and where they've operated, and also kind of the prominence that they too have now in Iraqi politics. Now, Sadr, because of his difficulties with the Iranians, again, these guys, just like Firqat al-Abbas al-Qataliyyah, they have a very strong connection with the Iraqi army. And they have a very strong connection with different state apparatuses. Maybe not the same as, say, you know, Firqat al-Abbas, but they are trying to build it in that way to show off a more nationalist kind of message. But again, these are also people who say they are fighting a jihad. They are fighting a jihad against the Islamic State, and that's how they kind of consider it. They've also threatened the Americans, too. So there's that angle on it as well. But, I mean, we've done Lebanon, we've done Iraq. I would say Bahrain, which doesn't really necessarily have what we would call a Shia militia, per se. They're more asymmetric groups, or, you know, using terroristic tactics like you know, blowing up, doing car bombs, or doing assassination attempts. I've done a lot of work on them. So there are two that are rather prominent, and they came out of what was called the February 14th Youth Coalition, which was the main kind of youth protest movement that was against the Bahraini government. So these two are called Saray al-Mukhtar and Saray al-Ashtar. Saray al-Ashtar has suffered quite a bit because there are a lot of different security crackdowns on them. And Saray al-Mukhtar while they've continued to launch different attacks, you can see that, you know, over the past couple of years, you know, the internal security forces in Bahrain have done a lot to kind of stop a lot of their movements. So there's that that's going on. It hasn't really gone away fully, but I mean, it's still kind of there. But those are two more prominent ones. And in Yemen, you have the Houthis under the group called Ansar Allah. I mean, I'm not really a big Yemen guy, so I don't try to talk about it that much. They technically have their own ideological beliefs, but what I have followed, you know, and mind you, they're Fiverr Shia. When we're talking about Shia militias, normally we're talking about what are called Twelver Shia, and that's kind of the majority of Shia that are in the world. But in Yemen, the Houthis are Fiverr Shia. They believe in the five imams. But it's interesting to see at the top levels of that group that they're coming closer and closer to the Iranians. And they're coming closer and closer in a number of different ways. You know, they're going to the holy city that's in Iran called Qom and doing theological training. And the theological training they get there is not kind of this normative style that people would be more used to that you kind of get in Najaf, you know, the more historically based one. It's far more ideological. There's far more of a commitment to, you know, the concepts of absolute wilayat al-faqih. And I think you're starting to see that filter into the group a hell of a lot more, not just with, you know, Iran shipping arms and stuff to them, but also on that kind of interesting ideological level. And the Iranians have definitely tried to push that quite a bit. How successful they'll be is another story. You know, you can take a few trips to Iran. It doesn't mean you're going to come out and join Hezbollah, right? You know, it's there's always some difficulties there. So those are pretty much most of the big and important ones.
Well, thank you. So my other question focuses on foreign fighters. And of course, there's been a large body of work on Sunni foreign fighters, especially with what's going on in Syria and Iraq. What about the Shiite foreign fighters? Who is the typical foreign fighter? I know you touched a little bit on regions earlier in the talk, but give us an idea of the foreign fighter situation for these militias.
Sure. You know, there's another concept that kind of bothers me. Foreign fighter, I used to put this up on Twitter a lot. I'm hardly ever on Twitter anymore because it just tends to aggravate me. But, you know, there was this whole thing where foreign fighter took on the term that it meant Sunnis who were joining ISIS or Al-Qaeda. That was it. That's what a foreign fighter is. You know, I was always under the impression that, you know, foreign fighters meant people from not from that country fighting in that country, you know, for whatever goals they want. I mean, hell, even the Kurds have, you know, PYD has foreign fighters.
Yeah, exactly. No, yeah. I completely agree with you on that topic.
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, I know you get it. It's, but unfortunately, you know, in media wise, you know, they just kind of use this like it's a synonym for that. And when it comes down to these Shia foreign fighters, there are a good number of them that I've counted. I mean, I have spreadsheets on it who have actually come from the West. It's not the same as ISIS coming out and saying, hey, we have fighters from the Maldives, we have fighters from Tunisia, we have fighters from Libya, we have this, you know. The Iranian-backed groups play it up at different at different levels so that they send the signal, hey, we've got guys from all over the place. However, because they're intelligent, and I say strategically intelligent, there's a different messaging strategy. They want to show that they have reach all over the world. So let's say back in 2013, there was one fighter who was supposedly from either Sierra Leone or from the Ivory Coast. Most reports have said he was from the Ivory Coast, who was with a Shia militia, and he got killed in Damascus. Well, wow, that's how exotic. That's interesting. Somebody coming from West Africa who's fighting with a Shia militia? Whoa, but there's only one mention of that. You didn't hear any other mentions of, you know, other West African fighters afterwards. Sometimes you'd watch a video and you'd see some of the faces and say, okay, that guy is not from Iraq, that guy is not from Syria. There's no real confirmation. It's just the signal. You get my drift on that? It's the, we'll send that message. But then there are other ones like from Afghanistan and from Pakistan. Those two countries have provided, you know, thousands of fighters to the IRGC's war machine in Syria and also in Iraq too. Where they've sent some of these guys and also lost some of them. So you do have those issues that are there. I mean, it's funny. There is this pro-Assad image that went around. It was like 2012 to 2013 where they showed this kind of like bifurcated image. And on top, they had these ISIS guys. They're all in, you know, ISIS gear, wearing all black and stuff. And you look at their faces, and there's in Arabic, it says, this one is from Germany, this one's from, you know, Turkmenistan, and this one is from China, and this one's from here and there. And then underneath, they go, this is the Syrian army from Syria, which is interesting and highly, highly ironic nowadays, given a lot of the fighters on the ground that are backing or bolstering the Assad regime are Lebanese Hezbollah, the Afghans who are in a group called Liwa Fatimiyun, the Pakistanis who are in Liwa Zainabiyun. You have a ton of different Iraqi groups that have been sending fighters there since the beginning, since around 2012. So, I mean, that's kind of the condition when we're looking at foreign fighters and how they're getting shipped over there. The other thing is, it's not the same process. I would make the argument that when people look at the Islamic State, the process of becoming a foreign fighter, it has kind of a sexier ring to it. And I say this because they have to go through Europe, and they're leaving their families, and, you know, they're going through Turkey, and maybe they're smuggling themselves over the border, or maybe there's this, or maybe there's that, and then they are in the so-called Islamic State. And so there's this whole, you know, this whole narrative that kind of gets built up with it. And so that, you know, you kind of look at it and you go, that feels like a foreign fighter. Whereas you have these Iraqis who will go over the border into Iran, they'll do some training, they can then get flown over often on Syrian Air or a variety of different Iranian cargo or other flight providers, you know, different airlines. You know, they're getting flown over, and then they get off the plane, they visit a shrine, and then they go off to fight. Well, you know, it's not as intriguing in terms of a kind of a biographical detail when you're looking at a different group. Or, you know, a guy from Hezbollah, he gets in his SUV and he deploys to Syria, and he literally just drives over the border. You know, there's that too. So it doesn't really have that same ring or feel to it, I think, in many respects, despite the fact that they are, by definition, foreign fighters. But the other thing is, I brought this up, I touched on it a little bit, about Western foreign fighters. There are people, and again, foreign fighters who were coming from the West didn't always just join Iranian-backed groups. In fact, there are a number of and this is what the reports say, according to open-source media sources, but, you know, there are reports that had, you know, people who lived in Western countries who were joining, you know, Sistanist groups in Iraq to fight ISIS. Or they were coming from Europe and they were joining different groups in Iraq. Or sometimes, you know, they were coming from Canada. You know, there was a lot of different stories that were kind of hidden. And, you know, even Muqtada Sadr actually had a foreign fighter from, I think, somewhere in Scandinavia. I can't remember off the top of my head. But, you know, they have had these guys who have been in their ranks, and they do use them. And I think, you know, sometimes they use them for a different propaganda value than, say, the PYD does or ISIS has or Al-Qaeda has. There's, you know, a different structure to it. And I think sometimes it gets plowed over when, you know, you're focusing on the bigger pictures and also kind of the nitty-gritty that goes into that bigger picture that's more interesting for some when they're focusing on it. The other thing is, you know, in terms of operational security, these guys are often a hell of a lot better than the Islamic State guys. And I know that sounds, you know, it probably sounds a little iffy, but if you're not seeing funeral notifications for people, or you're not seeing that they're from, let's say, LA, or they're from, you know, Montreal or something, that definitely demonstrates that they know they don't want to harm, you know, their supporters who may be in those countries. It also shows that maybe, you know, there's other security issues that they're dealing with. I had called into a number of recruitment lines that I had found online, and I had done this from like 2013 till about 2016.
I remember having a whole conversation with you about this. It's an awesome story.
Well, I mean, the classic one was when I speak, I usually speak in a Lebanese form because I love Lebanese. It's got nuance and character. I know all of my Iraqi friends are going to laugh at me and say, "Yeah, but you sound like a girl." But whatever. still, I'm not always the best when it comes to it, and sometimes you can definitely hear my Americanisms over it when I'm speaking. So one of the funny times was I had called into one of these recruitment lines, and they said, "No, we just want Iraqi brothers to join this group. You can say a prayer for us, but we really don't need you to come from, because I said, oh, I'm in America right now. We don't really need you to come from America to do this. Well, that's interesting. You know, that definitely demonstrates that they already know that they have enough people in said country. Why would they need to pull in people from France or people from America? And I think sometimes that also gets lost. You know, there's, like I said before, there's that sexy factor to it. Oh, look at the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda. They need to bring in all these people from all these diffuse places. And, you know, they're going to bring them in and mold them together. I mean, obviously on a different end, and I'm sorry I keep juxtaposing them to, you know, Al-Qaeda and ISIS. But again, we're talking about what people are focusing on in terms of militant Islamist groups or jihadist groups. It is interesting that, you know, that kind of takes a precedence, you know, when you're looking at the academic literature and when you're looking at media reports. Oh, well, you know, they had 500 fighters who came from France, or they had 20 who came from Belgium, or, you know, whatever. With these guys, they know where their power base lies. And also strategically speaking, you know, if you're recruiting people directly from those countries that you can possibly have the most influence over, whether it's because you're geographically linked to them or culturally linked, or maybe you're worried about security issues, you know, how many people really want to pull in somebody who's in America because they might be, you know, like with some intelligence organization here, you know, maybe that's not as safe. So, you know, it's a really interesting way to kind of see how they have processed that and how they view themselves in terms of building, you know, not just a regional army, but building one that is cohesive and does what they want for a longer term plan.
Is there a unifying ideology amongst the foreign fighters that spans the different militia groups, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, again, it depends. I would say yes and no. Yes, because, for Iranian-backed organizations, and I'm speaking specifically about them, and we're talking the Iranian-backed Shia militia groups, many of them, actually I would say the vast majority, probably 99.9% of them, they swear allegiance to Khamenei as the supreme leader. And that is, you know, an ideological belief that they have to push. They have to push the absolute Wilayat al-Faqih, where, you know, the buck stops with Khamenei and it stops with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. So that is kind of a unifier. But when you look at it, you know, how many, because this is a long-term structure that they follow, how many of the rank and file are true believers when it comes to that? Now, there have been different claims on both sides. On one side, you'll see people who say, yeah, absolutely, Wilayat al-Faqih is truly winning out because it's becoming legitimized, because, you know, they're showing how prominent they are and how they're protecting the Shia as a whole, and maybe people take this as a message that they should be following that. Then there's the flip side to that argument. And the flip side to the argument, you can just see it. You know, they recruit people. And by the way, the Islamic State recruited people, too, using these methods, using different incentives. You know, if I'm a farmer in Maysan and I'm not making all that much money and somebody offers me $1,000 a month to go and fight in Syria, and I get trained and I get to have the honor of holding a weapon and I get to be part of a group, and the group may lead to other employment opportunities or other different political connections, kind of building, you know, a wasta for themselves, like clout and connections. It certainly sends a message. It helps with recruitment. But then again, how firm of a believer can you make people like that? Are they just doing it for the cash, or are they doing it because they are for the sake of Khamenei and for the sake of Imam al-Mahdi? I think there's another angle to it, too. You know, there is the concept in across the board for most of these groups that they are always fighting what's called a defensive jihad. And in Shiism, that's kind of how jihad was traditionally classified, where it was defensive in nature. Of course, you'll have Lebanese Hezbollah, which will launch an attack against the Israelis, obviously an offensive action, but they'll say, no, it was actually a defensive action, because you're not looking at it from our perspective. You know, you'll get that kind of newer notion. So there is kind of that sense that's filtering there. You know, if I am a Shia, and I'm seeing the Islamic State blowing up my shrines, blowing up important historical sites, killing my people, destroying the country that I'm living in. I mean, you bet your ass I'm going to go out there and fight. I'm going to go and do that. So I think there's incentives, you know, that come on from that angle, too. And there's also the religious rulings. You know, I think it's interesting, you know, you look at Ayatollah Sistani, who did not, it doesn't really support these Iranian-backed organizations, has his problems with them, but he's treading a very, very, very fine line. You know, he's walking a tightrope that is, you know, like dental floss. But what does he do? He called for, you know, people to join state institutions in Iraq and state bodies to fight off the Islamic State threat. So sometimes you have people who are not as politically aware or even understand which group they're joining. Maybe they can't join the army for whatever reason, or can't join internal security forces because they don't have the connections. But hey, they can join Asayib Ahl al-Haq, they can join Kitab Hezbollah, and then sometimes they get sucked into that, and then they get killed, and they become, you know, a Kitab Hezbollah martyr, or, you know, whatever. So sometimes that happens as well. It's not kind of a clear cut, you know, oh, you know, the Ayatollah pressed the button and that means every Shia is going to get up and start fighting. It doesn't work that way. And, you know, like I said before, there's a diverse set of views and a diverse set of reasons for why people go to fight. Now, for Syria, this is a whole other angle. When we look at that, you know, initially you had people who were within Iranian-backed networks and people who were living in certain neighborhoods within Syria. And so sometimes it was more of a defensive nature for why they were doing it. Other times there were cash incentives. And then yet other times it was true ideological commitment. Hezbollah would not be there if a taklif was not issued by Khamenei through his clerical apparatus to Hezbollah. There's a reason why they went. They were following said taklif. They were following this religious order that they had to go and they had to advise and help and, you know, fight these other forces on the ground in Syria. So, you know, you do have that, but it's, you know, it's a kind of a muddied type of look at things. It's not, you know, like I said, it's not really clear cut all the time.
Once again, another topic that we hear constantly about foreign fighters, especially the Sunni foreign fighters, is what happens to them if and when the Syrian war has a finish or is resolved. In your opinion, what happens to the Shiite foreign fighters that are involved in this conflict?
Well, I'll focus just on the Iranian back one so I don't go off into too many different little things. I think that when you look at a lot of these Iranian-backed groups, if you look at the structure of them, Hezbollah has never laid down its arms. Asayib Ahl al-Haq has never laid down their arms. Fighter organization has never laid down their arms. Having arms and having a section that one can call, you know, al-Muqawama al-Islamiyya, the Islamic resistance, if you can have something like that, that is one of the most important things that you need to have to be, you know, a true group that is, you know, founded in this Hezbollah model. You know, they need to have arms. They need to retain them. And I think that with the successes that the Iranians have had with these groups, they're going to want to keep a lot of these people on board. They're going to want to keep the networks going. It doesn't necessarily mean they always need, you know, 14,000 fighters in one group at any given time, especially not if they're, you know, they're not going to have a war or anything. But, you know, I think that these groups are here to stay. They don't want to go anywhere. And no one's really pushing back against them in any way, you know, in any meaningful way anyway. And I'm talking politically, clerically, or, you know, or militarily. You know, America will send signals, don't get too close, and they'll bomb a, you know, a technical or something, and they'll bomb some militia forces that are there. But it's not, you know, it's not like dismantling the entire group. I mean, the other element to this is, and I said this, with the political links, you know, they're trying to enmesh themselves with the political apparatuses in their host states. And they are trying to achieve the mantelpiece kind of image that they essentially are the state. Their methods, their structure, that is the state, and that's who you need to look at. Whether they are functioning in, you know, a sub-state kind of apparatus, or they're even, you know, functioning in terms of like a state within a state, like Hezbollah kind of has. It's this, again, it's kind of a weird picture because, you know, a lot of people who, you know, if you're studying this in an institution, you know, they look at how does the institution work with X, you know, and how does the government work with them? These guys are pretty much trying to take any low-hanging fruit and some of the upper, some of the fruits at the top of the tree too. Anything they can get their hands on and utilize and build themselves up so that they can eventually achieve the ends that they desire, which, you know, if they're following Khomeini's ideology, it means this pan-Islamic, imamate of sorts that they would want to achieve, then yeah, you know, they're going to do what they need to do. It's not as clear-cut and black and white as, say, the Islamic State rolling into territory somewhere in Syria, taking over the village and saying, ha, the caliphate is here. You know, this is what we have, and this is our state now. They are doing that kind of long-term process. So when we wonder what will happen with a lot of these militias afterwards, this doesn't mean that some of them will, it doesn't mean that all of them will exist. Sometimes you have different personality issues. Sometimes you have funding issues. Sometimes a cleric who may actually support absolute Wilayat al-Faqih, maybe he finds a group that he likes more. Maybe he doesn't like whatever group he was just supporting, and maybe he had a fight with their clerical leader. Maybe the clerical leader, because of pressures within the Iraqi political structure, maybe he's saying, well, maybe it's smarter for me to at least nominally claim that I'm going to disarm my group. And I can get a political position, I can get some money with that, and beyond that, I can possibly, supply my supporters with jobs and connections and a feel of officialdom. So that's a possibility as well. But seeing how the Iranians have really worked their networks, especially the networks, I'm obsessed with these Muqtada Sadr splinters that have occurred over time. You know, they knew where to go for fighters who would do what they wanted. They knew how to approach these networks, and they knew how to utilize them as best they could. So when the time comes, you may not hear of some political entity. You may not hear of some, guy who maybe had a political seat in like 2014, and he just disappeared off the map. But if they need him for a purpose, let's ring him up and we'll use him again. They're very, very good at that. And it's, it's like the little prairie dogs popping up from their holes every once in a while, mm-hmm. And that's kind of how it functions sometimes. Obviously, there are other groups too that are quite prominent in building different connections. I mean, the Butter Organization, which I brought up, is a prime example of this. They want to get themselves into the state apparatus, the apparatus that is al-Hashd al-Shaabi, in terms of completely controlling it. So they're working on that too. But I don't really see these groups, and this is kind of on a 30,000-foot view, really going anywhere. They're always going to be around, and they have now built themselves up and sacrificed a lot of blood. And when you do that, it builds a very, very strong connection with, a lot of the other organizations and with this hoped-for goal that they have. I think it's still going to linger there for a while. I mean, in Syria, this is another example, too. What has Hezbollah and what have the Iraqi Shia jihadist groups who have been sent there, what exactly are they pushing? Well, they've tried to build up this tiny Shia community that's within Syria. They've tried to build them up into a Hezbollah-style organization. And now said Hezbollah-style organizations want to run for Syrian parliament, and they want to be involved, and they want to be officially recognized, and they want to take prominent roles within the military apparatus. Well, what does that tell you? They're following a method that worked very well in Lebanon and in Iraq, and it only helps extend Iran's influence. And once you do that, it's very, very hard to dislodge them, especially if they just want to keep existing and keep getting checks and keep doing what they're doing.
To wrap up the conversation, I've got like the big picture question for you. And that's, what is the Shiite militia in Syria and Iraq? What is their future? We've seen a lot of current loss in territory from ISIS. So do you think the Shiite militia will play a more prominent role in the region, or is there something else in their future?
Well, they're definitely going to play a more prominent role in the region. There's no going back on that one. They have built for themselves their own roles. They are trying to get into the political apparatuses that are across the region. They are militarily powerful. These are the forces that are really, in the case of Bashar al-Assad, these are some of the main forces that are keeping him going. And there's really no denying it. They're not going anywhere. But I will say there will be changes on the horizon. And when I say changes on the horizon, there is a whole public perception that they did not have earlier on. Hezbollah, you'll remember, had a very, very positive perception in the broader Arab or Islamic world because of, their fight against the Israelis. Obviously, that changed with with issues in Syria. But guess what? If Bashar al-Assad is in power in Syria and Hezbollah helped him get there, and you have these other groups that helped push the Islamic State out of Iraq, and they are credited with, you know, saving Baghdad, and, you know, they've kind of built their own networks of you know, employees and different people who are around who rely on these groups. Well, what does that mean? It means that they're taking on other social functions, they're taking on any on other state functions, they're taking on, you know, institutional functions. And, you know, I think for a lot of policymakers who look at it, the bigger question is, okay, so how do you deal with these guys when they decide they want to fight you? How do you declare war in Iraq if Butter is sending, you know, guys into Lebanon and they're fighting alongside Hezbollah against the Israelis? You know, if you're the Israelis, like, what do you do? Do you start targeting Baghdad? You know, it creates a lot of different issues that are moving forward. And the other thing is, you know, we're already seeing a lot of the steps that they have for longer-term strategy. What happens when it comes to fruition when they dominate a government or they win elections? And I say win elections, not a few parliamentary seats and not, you know, a few disparate candidates who are here and there, and, you know, they're not really concentrating on it. But if they dominate the institution, they have a state within a state, they have other institutions that allow them to carry arms and to do whatever they want, at what point do Western governments say, okay, you know, X state is not X state anymore. They're now something else that we can't really describe. So I think that, you know, we should really watch for that. The other issue is, and I wrote an article, I think, back in 2015. God, I feel terrible. I'm now, like, turning into one of these DC people who goes, you know, my work on it, my reporting on it.
But You're good.
But it's what I'll say is, I wrote this piece for Foreign Policy that the next front would be with the Israelis. And again, I think we're kind of seeing it now, and we've been seeing it for the past couple of years. They want to, the Iranian-backed groups, these Shia militias, want to turn the Golan into, you know, a hot front. It used to be quite cold. You know, Bashar al-Assad tried to keep things quiet there. So what happens now once they're done mopping up any resistance that's in Syria? Well, now that you have these strong forces with new training, with new equipment, with new strategies, where do they turn next? Do they immediately go off to war again? Do they go off to war, you know, against an American ally? And how does the United States respond to that? How do Gulf states, which are also fighting a lot of these groups, you know, how do they respond to it? I mean, you're changing a lot of regional dynamics that, you know, and I'm using the word change very, very loosely because, again, we could kind of see this developing anyway. But, you know, what happens after? You know, what happens the day after? And then what happens the day after that day? There are a lot of questions that I think that are going to start popping up that we're going to have to address, and I don't really think there are very many good solutions. And I don't really think that, you know, the United States especially has the stomach to deal with what they're viewing as too much complexity and, you know, not enough positive movement from anything. You know, it's very, very hard to deal with a situation like that. And I think, you know, you look at how Europe is going to respond to this. When they're negotiating things in the Middle East, do they negotiate with Tehran first? Or what are they going to do? Same thing goes with the Gulf. Do they reach some kind of status quo with Tehran and say, okay, you know, here's your slice of the pie and here's ours? I don't really know. I mean, the Middle East is often a very zero-sum game kind of place. And that usually leads to more conflict. And especially if you are hyper-ideological in your demands and what you want to do, and let's say you want to wipe a state off the face of the earth, as they've said repeatedly about the state of Israel, you know, that kind of creates, you know, a whole other can of worms. So, you know, I think their prominence, you know, their prominence is certainly adding to the picture in terms of making them more threatening. And then beyond being more threatening, their prominence in other circles kind of says to people, well, then how does a war end? You know, how does a struggle end if they're already dominating everything else? You know, where do people go with this? How do they deal with it? So I think those are some of the key issues.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been an absolutely fantastic discussion. I've personally learned so much, and your wealth of information is always just mind-blowing. So thank you so much, Philip, and Congratulations on the Sora Fellowship again. I'm so excited for you.
Oh, I really appreciate it. Thank you. I'm sorry I was all over the place today, but it was a real honor to be on.
Oh, it's an honor to have you, so thank you.
Thank you.